We had the opportunity in 2012 to not only meet Senator Santorum, but to see what was inside. And Iowans rewarded him by winning the Iowa caucuses. So without further ado, I'm proud to introduce to you my good friend, Senator Rick Santorum.
I must admit, it's always weird hugging Cody. I mean, I feel like a munchkin land here. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Cody. It's honored to be introduced by you. It's great to be back here talking to a lot of familiar faces here in the Iowa delegation and having an opportunity to share some thoughts with you. Just a couple things, and then I'm going to do a little different thing. I'll make a few comments and then take a few questions because this is Iowa and that's what I got to do. Let me just first say, talking about Emily and the Growth Energy folks. Iowa's made a huge impression on me. You all know that. You've heard me talk about this, that my experience in campaigning in Iowa has really sunk into me, and I feel a real connection there. And I will tell you that after I left the election, one of the frustrations I had, and you need to know this, and Emily mentioned this, but you need to understand this. Outside of Iowa, in the political process, in the campaign process running for president, the issue of ethanol is a political loser. You go to New Hampshire, you go to South Carolina, you go to all these other states outside of the grain belt. They think the only reason the ethanol is in the gas tank is because Iowa's the first in the nation caucus. That's what they believe. They believe this is a boondoggle. They believe that it's a government subsidies, and particularly a lot of the conservative groups, unfortunately, like the Heritage Society and the Heritage Foundation, and others, they drive this message. And it's not based on any facts. It's based on a lot of myths. It's based on a lot of horrible inaccuracies. Now, I came to know that, and I supported the RFS. I supported the importance of having ethanol from a national security perspective part of the fuel mix here in this country. And I did when I was a United States Senator. But it really wasn't until I came to Iowa and I went to about a dozen starch plants and really got ensconced in the understanding of how this industry has just incredibly prospered in the technology and the innovation and all of the wonderful things that it does for the economy, not just of the grain states, but just for the overall energy mix of this country. You've got a great story to tell, and that's why I'm appreciative of what Emily said. You're not telling it, and you have a valuable part of your economy, and don't think that people are just going to recognize how good it is, because you have folks on the other side who would like to get rid of this industry and replace it with oil, and they are spending time, energy, resources, and getting that message out, and I don't think that's happening as effectively. And it doesn't. It has to come as much as Emily just talked about, organically, from the people who are most impacted by it, and that's you, and that's the people in the states that have the biggest stake. And of course, there's no bigger stake than Iowa. So, after the election, having gone through this process, I actually approached and I've never done this before. I actually approached them and said, "Look, I want to help you guys, because I think this is important for our country." And so I'm actually doing some work right now to try to help the ethanol industry get their message out in the conservative world and in other areas around the country that don't understand the tremendous benefits that ethanol provides. So I just want to share that with you, that you made an impact on me enough that I feel like I need to go out and help fight for what I think is right for this country. But I just encourage you to understand that you have a role to play in that. And whether it's in social media or whether it's in the political process, not just in the presidential primary, but beyond that. So I want to point that out to you, how important your industry is and the important role that you play in promoting that industry. Let me talk about the matter at hand here, which is, you know, what's happening here and what's going to happen here in the next few months. I have two things to say that I think are very, very important. People ask me all the time, you know, have you endorsed Donald Trump or have you support Donald Trump? And the answer is yes, I endorse Donald Trump. And, well, how are you a conservative? I mean, you know, how are you going to support someone who's not as conservative as you are and doesn't agree with you on everything? I said, look, there's only one perfect candidate, and I dropped out of the race. And so, but then we all feel that way. You know, we're the best. Ask the other 16 guys. So the fact of the matter is no one in this race agrees with us on all the issues. But this is a binary choice. It's a choice between two visions. And Donald Trump, I think, gave a very clear signal to all of us as to the direction he's going to take in his administration by picking Mike Pence. Mike Pence is solid. I've known Mike Pence since he was a House member. Mike and I are very good friends. When I actually thought about running for president back in 2010-11, the one person who was also thinking about it that I called and talked to and had multiple conversations about whether we were going to run or not was Mike Pence. So if you like Rick Santorum's politics, you will love Mike Pence's politics because he is as solid on all of the issues. He's a solid social conservative. He's a solid economic conservative. He's solid on national security. And he comes from the area of the country that is critical for this election for Donald Trump, and that's the Rust Belt, the Midwest. If we don't have a change of the map from Pennsylvania through Iowa and a little north of there, then we're not going to win this election. The map for Republicans is getting more daunting every single election cycle. It's not moving in our direction. And unless we can change that map and bring states in play that have not been in play for quite some time, we're not going to win this election. Trump gives us, with Mike Pence, the opportunity to do that, to win Pennsylvania, not just win Ohio, which, you know, we generally competitive here, but we haven't been all that competitive in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, yes, Minnesota, and of course, Iowa. We win those states, we're going to win this election, and we can win those states. And Donald Trump has a message that can win those states. I can tell you, I was in southwestern Pennsylvania when he gave his speech on trade. It was the most remarkable political event that I've been to in western Pennsylvania. I come from there. I walked into that aluminum recycling center in Monessen, Pennsylvania. When I ran for the Senate, Monessen, Pennsylvania, the registration in Monessen, Pennsylvania was, and I don't exaggerate, 90% Democrat. I would get 10 to 15% of the vote in Monessen when I would run for the United States Senate. So I'm in Monessen, and I walk in there, and the grandson of a former congressman comes up, says hello to me, and talks to me, a Democrat, another relative of another Democratic congressman, former state representatives, Democrats, mayors, up and down that valley, hardcore rock-rib Democrats, all at that recycling center to listen to Donald Trump and support him. The ability for Trump to be able to get voters that feel disenchanted from Democrats because Hillary Clinton is a Wall Street globalist. I mean, that's who she is. I mean, you know, look at all the foreign connections she has. She is not a blue-collar working person's candidate. And Trump is. And Mike Pence is, I hope he talks about this tonight. I talked to Mike, I guess, about two years ago. I went to see him in his office, and we sat, and we had a good, long conversation. And the one thing he brought up, because I had just written this book, Blue Collar Conservative, the one thing he brought up, he's so proud of, I hope he mentions tonight, that he put in universal vocational education in the schools in Indiana, with local community organizations, businesses, and educators to build programs within the school district that would meet the vocational needs of the kids to be able to get jobs in those local communities. He crowed about that. He said, by the way, it's the most popular thing I've done in the state of Indiana. Mike is a candidate that will fit beautifully into the message that Donald Trump has and will fit beautifully into the people in this country who are ticked off because, frankly, neither political party is paying attention to their struggles. And it doesn't matter the color of your skin. The ability to reach out and contrast. Imagine the Republican in this election being the candidate of working men and women, and the Democrat being the Wall Street international corporation representative. That, I remind everybody, some of you may have heard this in my speeches for years, 90% of American workers don't own their own business. They work for an agency or a business. So if we're on the side of working people, we have a much better chance electorally than winning than if we're on the side and are identified with the 10% of the people who own their businesses. That's a big change for us. And it doesn't come comfortably to some of us. But if we don't understand that that's who we are, that's who the Republican Party is becoming, and if we don't, as a leaders of the party, get that, then we are going to lose this election. If we don't start talking about and focusing on who wants to help us, but they have to know that we care and that we're talking about them. Well, Trump is. It's one of the reasons he's here and getting this nomination this week. The second reason this is very important, it's the reason I endorsed him. I tell the story, Trump called me after the election was pretty much up, Ted had dropped out and everybody had out. He called me and asked for my endorsement. He called me. I get on the phone. He said, so what's up, Rick? I said, well, Donald, I'm looking for a conservative to support for president. And he said, that's me. And he said, I'll be great. I said, yeah, I know you will be. So he's just on the phone. He's the same as he is in public, just so you know. And so we had a nice, we exchanged pleasantry and talked a little bit. I said, look, my big issue, this election, Donald, is about one thing. In the end, there's one thing that will be lasting in this election that will have a huge impact in this country going forward. And that's the United States Supreme Court. Just so you understand, there is, I went to the funeral of a very dear friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, Nino Scalia. And I sat in that cathedral, and it just rushed into me that the future of our democracy is at stake. And I don't say that lightly. With Scalia's death, the next president will appoint the swing vote in the United States Supreme Court. If Hillary Clinton is elected, here's what will happen. Not may happen. This is what will happen. She will appoint someone who's in their late 40s or early 50s, who is like the two other justices that Barack Obama's appointed, progressives who have the viewpoint of the Constitution that Justice Breyer has. There are two distinct points of view in the United States Supreme Court right now. The Scalia point of view, which is the Constitution says what it says, and we are limited by what is said in the Constitution, that the language that's there is meaningful, and that we are limited by that language. And then Justice Breyer, just so you understand, says the Constitution is meaningless. It is whatever we want it to say, and that we can find whatever. And we don't even need passages within the Constitution to make decisions about what is constitutional. In other words, the Constitution might as well be a blank sheet of paper. That the job of the court is to move with contemporary mores and theories to apply whatever is just. That's what Justice Breyer believes. That's what Elena Kagan believes. And that's what Sonia Sotomayor believes. And that's what Hillary Clinton's replacement of Justice Scalia will believe. And Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, both of whom will retire, I have no doubt, in this next term, will also be replaced with two 50-year-old folks who feel the same way. That means five, and there are nine justices, that means five Supreme Court justices who will be on that court for 25 to 30 years, who will destroy the rule of law in this country, who will destroy any semblance of what this Constitution or any limits on the power of government or the power of the secularists or the power of the sexual revolution, all of those things will be unbound. We will not be a constitutional republic anymore. Now, I know there are some progressives who relish that opportunity and say, wow, that is just the greatest thing for us. And here's what I would say to them. Do you want to be governed by five people? And their answer is yes, if it's the right five people, and it will be. But I said, okay, what happens when there is a backlash? And 25 years from now, because that's what it will take we will have maybe a majority of five conservatives who now are living under this same rubric, which is the Constitution is whatever we say it is. And they say Social Security is unconstitutional. And they say universal health care is unconstitutional. And they say abortion is unconstitutional. All of a sudden, the shoe's on the other foot. What can happen to the best? Careful what you ask for. We are going to lose who we are. That's what this election is about. And I can say this with 100% confidence. If Hillary Clinton is elected, we will not be a constitutional republic within your lifetime. If that isn't enough, for those of you who are worried about, oh, you know, he's this or he's that, or I don't agree with him on this, or I don't. This is about the republic. And if that can't fire you up, if preserving the republic for you, this generation and your children and grandchildren doesn't fire you up, then you're in the wrong place. You shouldn't be here. If you're looking for the perfect candidate, go home, read your Bible, and practice your faith and wait for the second coming. Because it isn't going to happen until then. Pray, but work. And Iowa, as it always does, matters. You're a swing state, and Donald Trump can win this state. But he's going to need everybody on a laboring oar. And that's what I'm asking you guys to do. I know you can do it. I know you folks. I know you can do this. I know Iowa can go for Trump. But he's going to need the Republican Party united. And it's not. Let's just be honest. It's not. In your own delegation, it's not. That's over. It's over. I mean, I know yesterday, it's over. It's now understanding what's at stake. It's a binary choice. It is time to save this republic. And Iowa is on the front line. And you have no excuse. You know better. If you didn't know better before this speech, you know now. It is at stake, and you have no one to point to and say, well, it should have been. It's over. It's now your turn. It's time to step up and kick in. I mean, I'm at the, I'll do whatever the campaign wants me to do. I've said that to the campaign. I mean, they've been focused clearly on this convention, but afterwards, I've said I'll do whatever's necessary. I'll certainly get out on media as much as I can. I'll continue to do TV and radio. I do have to feed my family, and that doesn't feed my family. So I'll be working in business and some other things, but. As you can see, I still care about this country, and if I can make an impact, I certainly am going to try. Yes, sir.
Rick, you mentioned very well the Constitution, the original foundations that the founders wrote into it, and the genius of it, and we've known that for years. Do you foresee any chance of reining in the power of the federal government, Supreme Court inclusion, to its original parameters?
Yeah, the biggest problem we have in our constitutional republic at this point is an abdication of authority by the Congress. The Congress has abdicated their role in the balance and the checks and balances and the balance of power, and has ceded it to the president and to the courts. And I'll pick an issue, and I know this is a conservative. The conservatives love this issue, and they drove this issue. But I can tell you, in a practical way, I know people are going to push back on me on this, but I'm just telling you the practical consequences of what this conservative movement was about in the last 10 years that has cost the Congress enormous power. Anybody know what I'm going to say? It's very unpopular. You'll say, what? No. Earmarks. Earmarks. Earmarks was the I remember 12 in 2012. I mean, everybody's going to get rid of earmarks. They're corrupt. They're this and that. Okay, you know what earmarks were? In the Constitution, who has the authority to spend money? And so what do we do with earmarks? We gave that authority to who? The president. Congress no longer can spend money. Oh, they can appropriate sums, but who gets to decide who spends where the money's spent? The president does. Why? Because Congress can't mark the money anymore. And you think that's a good thing? Who's the president? Why did you want to give him that power? And by the way, and I'm going to be real here. What were earmarks used to do? Come on, what were earmarks used to do when they had to pass bills? To get people to vote for the bill. Guess what we haven't passed in the last 10 years? Appropriation bills. Can't pass them. Well, so that's not right. Okay, it's not right. Human beings are flawed, failed characters, let me tell you, and congressmen are no different than any of you. And so you know what? They need a little sugar to make the medicine go down. And if all you're voting on is spending more money, and you don't get a little bit of goodies with the money being spent, I'm taking that medicine. I'm going to go home and say I'm a good, tough guy. That's what's happening. Why? Congress is full of people who are subject to human nature. And what we've done is destroy what for 200 years was used to get hard things done by getting people who are not so strong-willed or not so brave to come along and make things happen. You say, why doesn't Congress work? Because we've taken away their power and their tools to make it work. And that was one of the things we did. And I know I know people are going to say, I can't believe he's up there arguing. I'm just telling you, in practical ways, how things used to work. You can say, well, they should work differently. Good. Are they? No, they are not. And what's happening is a systematic abandonment of congressional authority to the president. All because Congress can't function anymore. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Earmarks was simply one. It's not the only one, but there's a lot of other things. And I just share that with you is that if you're looking for something that's going to fundamentally change how we get our constitutional republic back, then we have to start putting more power back in the Congress. We have to start encouraging them to stand up for their authority, and they're not. And I would argue it's because they've had weak leaders who are afraid to exercise that authority. And if you're a Democrat, and understand, because of the way the Democratic Party is this day, the Democrats are very happy to let the president and the courts do their bidding because they know that their policies can't be passed with majorities. So they get executive orders or they get court edicts to move their progressive agenda through. That's not us. We don't want to do it that way. We don't want the president to exercise authority, and we don't want the court to dictate conservative policies. What do we want? We want the Congress to work, but by our very actions, we make it harder for them to work. You gotta rethink. I know this is, to some of you, just sounds very odd, but conservatism and conservative principles are not going to be successful unless we have a stronger constitutional framework, which means a stronger Congress. And that's what conservatives should start focusing on. Anybody else?
Yeah, I have a question for you, Senator Santorum.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you feel about the folks that Mr. Trump has mentioned that he would appoint to the Supreme Court? What do you know about those? And give us some info.
Well, I mentioned the conversation. I told him I cared about the court. And he said, oh, I got that. I said, yeah. And he said, I've got a list I've been working on. And I said, great. I said, when are you going to publish that list? Well, you know, I just don't have enough names on the list. He said, if you got some names, he said, I appreciate it. I said, I'll send you some names. And he said, oh, great. He said, so who are you going to endorse me? I said, when I see the list. And I said, you see me? I want to see the list. I want to review who they are. And I want you to say that you will appoint some people. You will appoint people from this list. You do that, I'll endorse you. Now, I made that conversation was on a Friday. I sent him a name on Monday. And on Wednesday, he published a list with the name of the person I put on the list. And then 2 days later, I endorsed him after I reviewed the list. And by the way, the list is fabulous, including an Iowan, as you know.
Steve Colleton
from Iowa. And it's a fabulous list. Any one of those. I mean, there's some superstars. And here's the really interesting thing, save one, I think. None of them are from Yale or Harvard, okay? And I mean, I'm serious. This is not an elite group from the standpoint of the elite educational institutions. They're elite because they are powerful intellects. They are strong, principled folks. But it's a Trump list. It's a list that I know deliberately he wanted people who were not cut from that cloth. Because as we've seen from the Supreme Court, we appoint these folks from who are, quote, conservatives, and they went to all these elite institutions, and they end up not being so conservative as we thought they would be. I think Trump gets that. I don't think people give him credit for the instincts that he has and understanding human nature and the experience he's had in life. And I think that list, the two things I've seen from him that give me a lot of hope about how this man will govern is the list he put together. It is rock solid on the most important issue, the Supreme Court, and secondly, his pick for VP. Those are the two most important things this campaign has done, and as far as I'm concerned, 100% right on. And so if you're a conservative, there's a lot to be excited about from my perspective. Okay, I don't want to keep you guys any longer. If there's anybody else, we're good. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. God bless.